You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa, celebrating the sport and producing the finest cycling clothing since 2004. Today, we're in Saint-Gervais-les-Bains.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And on this triumphant day for the French, we're privileged and honoured to be joined once again by Jacques Godet prize winner. How much of an introduction can I give you? François Thomazeau.
Hi, guys.
Well, that certainly wasn't bullshit today, was it, François?
It's not bullshit, it's rain, you know. It's really, really, really rain. Cats and dogs, as you say, in England. Well, that's what I learned
Jacques
at school,
et
you
chien.
Know. Chaz et chien. Actually, we don't say that. We say il pleut des cordes. It's raining ropes. So that's the French expression.
Ah,
it was raining ropes today, and some of the ropes went on in the wheels of Chris Froome and others, but not on the wheel of Romain Bardet, who really snatched the win we the French were hoping for and expecting, and it was a great one.
Lionel, I should say, where are we, first of all? I forgot to do that. It's been an exciting day.
It has been very exciting. Well, we're in Saint-Gervais-les-Bains at the bottom of the final climb, Le Betex. If you can hear the thunder rumbling.
Oh,
that's not Richard's stomach. That's a very low cloud. The cloud has really descended down, and it's a very grey sky, raining quite hard. We're sheltering outside a cafe. I'm getting slightly wet. We perhaps should have gone into the rather wonderfully named Royal Splendid Hotel across the road there, but we haven't done that. We're just perched here rather awkwardly waiting for...
Well, François and I are quite comfortable.
You two are both...
You're sort of on the edge there, Lionel.
Yeah, you're both dry.
But you've got the most waterproof head of the three of us.
I have. So the tale of the attack then, Richard. Let's get on with the stage, shall we? Instead of... save the insults for Sunday, shall we? Right, stage 19 from Albertville to Saint-Gervais-Mont Blanc. 146 kilometres. Four climbs, including the final one to the finish at Le Betex. Great day for Romain Bardet and an eventful one for almost everyone else as the rain fell towards the end of the stage. Early on, a very handy 20-man break got away, including Raphaël Mica, of course, Pierre Rolland, Danny Navarro, Rui Costa, Thomas de Gendt. Astana led the chasing for most of the day, and the real key part of the stage came in the final 50 kilometres, when Pierre Rolland and Rui Costa got away together. They were on a descent as a few spots of rain began to fall. The roads became slippery and Pierre Rolland of Cannondale crashed on a bend, slipped all the way across the road into the mud. His bike just went away from him. It was a treacherous combination of fresh tarmac and just a few blobs of rain, putting the seal on a terrible tour for Cannondale. That left the former world champion Rui Costa of Lamprey away on his own. That wasn't the beginning of the drama. I mean, there's so much more to come. In brief, there was a crazy few minutes on the descent. Danny Navarro, who was chasing Rui Costa, he crashed and was forced to abandon. Bauke Mollema got away briefly on the descent with AG2R's Mikael Scherel, but Mollema misjudged a corner and went straight on into the trees. While all that was going on, Romain Bardet was bridging up to his teammate Scherel, and that was the move that eventually netted Bardet the stage win, the first for the French in this tour. Behind him, Richie Porte went down and had to chase back on with his BMC teammates. Then the yellow jersey Chris Froome crashed and swapped bikes with Geraint Thomas and rode the rest of the stage, including the final first category climb, on Thomas's bike. Bardet's lead nudged up to a minute as he caught and passed Rui Costa. Mollema was losing a lot of time. Adam Yates cracked in the final 3 kilometres and battled to limit his losses. Port attacked a couple of times, but perhaps did too much because he blew up and lost time as well. And after all that, Chris Froome actually increased his lead by 19 seconds. Incredible, really. It's almost a Teflon man in this Tour de France. No matter what happens, he comes out with more of an advantage. Poor old Bauke Mollema fell from 2nd to 10th. Yates has gone from 3rd to 4th, which means that Romain Bardet and Nairo Quintana now occupy the podium position behind Froome with one more day of climbing to go. And guess what? Rain is forecast tomorrow as well.
Heavy rain tomorrow, and all changed. I was even more impressive than anything that happened today on the bike. François just ordered 3 beers using only hand gestures. That was remarkable.
Yeah, you know, some gestures, you know, are known the world over, you know. Like I did this with my fingers, 3, and that little up and down gesture that makes, you know,
a pint of beer.
Exactly.
Fantastic. Yeah. Well, we'll see what arrives before we congratulate you too much. We don't know what you've ordered. But a tremendously exciting day, and nobody wants to see riders fall off, but the Tour did need a bit of drama and excitement, didn't it? And I felt very sorry for Pierre Rolland, who was riding very well, and who knows how that move with Rui Costa would have turned out in the end, had he remained on his bike, you know, it might have been a stronger combination to work with Romain Bardet when he got across, and Bardet might have maybe taken a little bit more time, who knows. A lot of the crashes, though, came, I think, as a result of an error. I mean, Froome seemed to brake on a white line and it slipped. We're going to hear from Peter Stettin in a bit. He talked about how treacherous that particular road was, because they went up it in the time trial yesterday and there was a lot of paint on the road, additional paint to just the lines. Malcolm Mollema, we never saw that crash at all, his Stettin, his teammate, but apparently he had attacked with Cherrel when he came off, before Bardet then went across. So it was all happening. The cameras couldn't be everywhere. There was a lot that went on. It's what we love about bike racing, isn't it? Piecing together what might have happened. And a day of high drama that sets things up nicely for the final day in the Alps tomorrow.
It was like a piece of old school cycling, because in the old days, as you know, television didn't have that many cameras and you had to guess sometimes what happened, and sometimes you knew 50 years later. You know, today we never know exactly what happened to Malcolm Mollema. There might have been other crashes or other problems that we're not aware of yet, you know, and that's what makes cycling exciting. What was exciting too, and that's what Romain Bardet said, he said in the last climb, you know, I just took out my earplugs, I didn't listen to what the team directors were saying, I just went on instinct. And he made it clear that, you know, he was a little bit fed up himself, all the SRMs and you know, mathematics and all the precision that that you know, cycling has now become. I mean, I don't know if it's entirely right, because actually he came here, spent 3 days, you know, checked the course many times, he picked the right bike, he knew what he was doing, he had Cherrel on top of him. I mean, it was all very carefully planned, and they knew what they were doing. He said he trusted his bike, he knew he wouldn't crash, so there was a lot of preparation about that. But he felt obliged to say at the end of the day, you know, this is cycling the way we like it, cycling by instincts, cycling by humans, and not cycling made by machines, watts, and that kind of things.
I mean, playing to his audience there, wasn't it? The French love to hear all that, don't they, Francois?
The romantic side of cycling.
Yeah, and the first French win of the tour. Hats off to him, because he rode tremendously well. It was a great move to go across with his teammate. Almost hit a car at one point, so he almost brought himself off. But, you know, what was most impressive was that obviously people sense a little bit of weakness, potential weakness in Chris Froome, and Astana made the race hard. Richie Porte had a few goes. Nairo Quintana was there. People were having a go at Froome. The race was fast behind, and yet Bardet was really holding on to most of his lead. It did creep up towards a minute, but he held it around 30 seconds for a lot of the way up that climb, which I thought was hugely impressive.
I've got to say, Romain Bardet is playing to the crowd there with what he said, because that move by AG2R in a surprising place, not attacking on a climb, attacking before the climb, had to have been predetermined, particularly having a teammate up there as well. I mean, it was interesting, a couple of days ago at the lake, I caught a few words from Tanel Kangert,
Tanel Kangert.
Yeah, I've said it both ways, so one will be correct.
Tanel Kangert.
And he was saying, you know, he was asked what can be done to combat Sky, and he said maybe we all just have to think differently. We have to attack in different places, maybe on the downhill, maybe on the flat, maybe with teammates. Which was surprising, given that Astana's tactics were so conventional today, riding hard tempo on the front.
What Bardet said, he said that it was actually Mika Cherrel or maybe Samuel Dumoulin, who is their, you know, road captain, who said, apparently told him, let's go to the top of Domancy, because it was the same Côte de Domancy that we had yesterday in the time trial. And he said, and let's make believe, let's pretend that the finish is at the top of Domancy. And so they sprinted to that finish line, and then obviously they had a little bit of a lead coming down, you know, and he's, well, Bardet insisted it was done at the spur of the moment, like, you know, reminding us of another so-called unpremeditated attack on the descent by Chris Froome earlier in the tour. But the thing is, this Côte de Domancy is so well known because the time trial was on it, but it also because it's where Bernardino was world champion. It's becoming a monument of French cycling, you know. It was where Bernardino was world champion in 1980. It was the place of the time trial yesterday. And now Romain Bardet might have, you know, earned his place in Tour de France history on the same climb.
And may end up on the podium, Bardet. I mean, really, you know, we talk about Team Sky's attention to detail and so on. And then something like that happens that, you know, no amount of planning can really eliminate the risks, the dangers that these guys face all the time. A little observation at the finish, so we were at the buses, and we always, you know, if you mention something that Sky are doing that other teams aren't doing, you go, this is marketing BS and PR and all the rest of it. But just an observation I made, that the weather did close in, it was getting cold. The Sky riders, as it came down, were in full winter gear, jackets, hats and everything. All the other riders, without exception, were in their racing kits still, or rain capes. A couple had buffs around their necks, but that was an interesting little little observation. I thought that Sky had prepared for the riders to descend 5 or 6 kilometres back to the team buses. Let's hear from Peter Stetina, a Trek Segafredo rider, American rider on that team. Kaylee Fretz and I spoke to him after the stage. He was helping Balkamolam after his crash. He was as much in the dark, as you'll hear, about exactly what happened as any of us. Here is Peter Stetina.
So we started the crazy descent that was from the time trial yesterday, and there was so much pain on the road, it became mayhem. My guys were slipping and sliding everywhere. Came around a bend, and I saw Bauke getting up from the ground. So waited for him for a second, and then we were still on the very back of the peloton, but there were gaps and crashes everywhere. Then there was another crash, and I think that's when Heimar went off the road. And Bauke and I made it to the bottom of the downhill, and there was a slight gap to the Astana-led peloton. We just code red, full emergency situation, and I just time trialed as hard as I could for the 2K in the flat before this climb. And I think we hit the climb just maybe 10 seconds behind the peloton, but I was going so hard, and you know, I think when you start the climb in already over the limit a little bit, when the other guys are fresh and having being able to sit on for a minute, then he had to try to limit his losses. And yeah, you start in the red, you can't fight when the guys make that first acceleration. So,
I mean, it must be very disappointing for the team. He was on the attack when he crashed originally, we understand.
I don't know. I don't know if he was on the attack or what. I was in the peloton, but it was so twisty. You never know what exactly is happening, and you know, with the weather, the radio communications were a mess. It was hard to figure out what's going on. It's just a shame that 19 stages of hard work is being erased by a stupid little spill. So, I haven't even seen results yet. We'll recalibrate, take stock tonight, and see if there's anything left to get out of this.
Did you see Bauke at the finish? Did you have a chance to speak to
him? No, he got in a car pretty quick and headed back to the hotel. So I'll see him at the dinner table tonight, and we'll commiserate or something, figure it out. So
you said you went into code red. What is that, just sort of everyone ride as hard as they can, find the leader and ride as hard as you can?
Emergency, yeah. Don't panic, but in a really panicky voice. So, yeah, just full emergency. For me, I mean, I was the only guy with him at that point, so it was just time trial as hard as I could to the bottom of the climb. And I was able to, I don't know, maybe claw back a few seconds or keep them equal, but you know, when you have 5 Astanas and just me, it's... at least it was only 2K. So...
Well, there you go, Rich. And Francois, it bears out what you were saying. When you're watching on the TV and then trying to piece together what happened, when the Trek rider ran off the road, went straight on that gentle corner, I assumed that that was Balkamolam, and it was actually Heimar Zubeldia, Rich.
I thought it was Peter Stetina, so we've covered all possibilities there. But yeah, Stetina said it was Zubeldia. You know, it was a confusing situation, and he was really disappointed. Everybody who came back to the Trek bus was really gutted for Mollema. It's the third Grand Tour in a row, as one of our colleagues mentioned at the bus, the third Grand Tour in a row that a Dutchman has fallen off the podium in the last few days. Tom Dumoulin at the Vuelta last year on the second last day, wasn't it? Then Steven Kruiswijk at the Giro crashed into a bank of ice and snow, and now Mollema has also crashed just when he seemed to be heading for the podium. He'd had a couple of difficult days, but today seemed back on it again.
Mollema did the same in 2013. He was second as well and finished and ended up, what was he, sixth or seventh? Dropped back badly. So, yeah, you're right. There's a Dutch jinx there. You would have thought that in the rain they would be doing all right. There's another factor that's important, because I talked to to Alain Galopin, he's the Trek team director, in the morning. And he told me what's going to be important in the rain. He didn't expect Bauke to lose that much time. He said it's the equipment. He said that there are riders who like going down. They like descent. There are riders who don't like them, but the most important thing is very often is the bike. If you have the right bike and you trust your bike in a descent, then you ride it safe. So I guess probably the choice of, I don't know, tires or, you know, even the bike itself. Apparently, and that's what Romain Bardet said as well. He said, I had total confidence in my bike, and I knew I couldn't crash.
Just on the Dutch, Rich, one rider that I didn't mention in the tale of the attack who suffered misfortune today is Tom Dumoulin. Of course, second in the time trial yesterday. His big target for the rest of the summer is the time trial at the Olympic Games in Rio. And today he crashed and apparently has fractured his left wrist. And the early prognosis is that, you know, with 19 or 20 days to go until that time trial, you know, normal recovery time would be twice that. He's still committed to going to Rio, but that will clearly have a bearing on his ability to ride hard in that time trial, given how hilly it is.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
We heard there from Eurosport. Thank you very much to Eurosport for sponsoring our daily Pedalar de Charme award. Lots of nominations today. And it's appropriate that we've just been joined, actually, by, I don't know what, Journaliste de Charme, Race Radio de Charme. But I'll mention who is our winner today. It's Luke Rowe, who was a very popular nomination. I think initially he was spotted handing his musette to some kids after the feed zone. That was a nice thing to do. And then he gave Adam Yates a big push while Adam Yates was sort of struggling at the back of the group. He gave him a big push. Don't know if that's allowed. Is it? Is that allowed? Seb Piquet, did you have a good view of that?
I had a few views of that. He wasn't the only one to push him. And apparently Yates will be given a 10-second penalty.
Wow, breaking news.
Yeah, an additional 10-second penalty for...
receiving assistance from...
Exactly. Probably Plaza, I think.
Yeah.
Wow, so maybe Sky should go around pushing all of their rivals. Give Quintana.
Yeah, I mean, if all of them can give Quintana a push at some point, he'll lose about a minute.
I don't know if it applies only if it's a team member who does it to you.
It's strange, isn't it? Because it was odd in a way, you know, that in theory, here was a guy in third place overall being pushed by a teammate of the guy in first. It obviously, you know, blood is thicker than water or something. He was helping out a fellow British rider, but it was nice to see anyway. And even if it's caused a bit of problem, he will have the consolation of a Pedalar de Charme t-shirt, Luke Rowe, which I'm sure he'll be happy with that. How was your day, Seb? How was it out there?
It was pretty hectic. And actually, to be honest, I didn't see that many crashes. I saw the first few crashes, the Francis Dijon guys crashing, Richie Porte crashing, but I never saw Froome crash. I only said on Radio Tour that he crashed because I could see his back. Blood on his back, but it was hectic.
Well, it's quite challenging for you, I guess, because you are having to give information out pretty quickly about what's going on in the race. And today, a lot of the main guys, the main contenders, fell off, and you've got to be able to identify that rider correctly, haven't you?
Well, I have to be close enough to see if there's a crash, which doesn't always happen, because when you have a group of 40, 50 riders, obviously the crashes sometimes happen at the front, so I can't see what goes on. But if I don't see the crash, I see if there's damage. Mm. I mean, we saw Nibali's shorts were ripped to pieces, and we did see that Froome had crashed. The same went for Mollema. We didn't see the crash of Mollema, but we did.
Once we
overtook him,
nobody did.
Yeah, but he did crash, I can tell you.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, talking about Chris Froome's crash, I mean, he had to finish the stage on Geraint Thomas's bike, which was more or less the right size, but...
That's the oval ring.
But without the oval ring, and that's a very interesting point, because earlier on today, I spoke to Kayleigh Fretz of Velo News, a tech expert. He understands all of this kind of stuff. A few listeners have emailed in and mentioned on Twitter, can you explain why Chris Froome rides these oval rings and whether they give any kind of advantage? So let's hear Kayleigh's assessment of Chris Froome and his oval chain rings.
This year, he's definitely the only big name rider. I haven't done a thorough count and checked every single bike that's here, but yeah, he's definitely the only sort of big name that's on them, that's for sure.
They've been knocking around for a long while. I remember Bobby Julich when he was with CSC riding them. That must be over 10 years ago now.
Yeah, and there are a couple different types. The ones that Froome is on called Osmetrics, and then Rotor also makes another version that's sort of less dramatic. They've definitely sort of bounced around. Wiggins has used them. Obviously, Froome has used them. They've won a whole bunch of Tours de France over the last couple of years, actually. But in the end, most of the peloton still seems to prefer a round chainring.
So what's the theory behind them? Is there any conclusive scientific evidence to suggest that they give any sort of gain in terms of watts?
The answer to the second question very much depends on who you ask. The basic theory is that your gear ratio changes throughout the pedal stroke. So effectively, you have a harder gear on the parts of the pedal stroke where you produce more power, which is sort of that, you know, like 1 to 4 or 5 o'clock kind of pedal position, and then a lighter gear in the sort of the two dead spots, top and bottom of your pedal stroke. That is essentially the idea. The science remains, as far as I've seen, and I've seen a couple different studies come out, remains mostly inconclusive. They do mess with the way that a crank-based power meter reads power, and so I think depending on how the study is done, there's potentially room for error there. You know, I think if there was a dramatic difference for every rider, and if it was just sort of an automatic wattage gain, you'd see pretty much the entire Peloton on them. That is definitely not the case. They take some time to get used to, so riders have to use them for a little while before they can actually race with them. And then even once you're used to them, there's no definitive proof that they improve performance. There's also no definitive proof that they harm it. So if it just makes someone's spin feel better, I can see why a guy like Froome might want them. The only downside, really, is that they don't shift particularly well. In fact, they shift exceptionally poorly. And if you talk to the Shimano guys, who are the sponsors of Team Sky, those guys would definitely prefer that Froome was on their own chain rings. With DI2 in particular, the electronic shifting in particular, they can make it work, but it's definitely not good.
So when you say shift, you mean changing gear. So the chain's a little bit clunkier, is it?
Yeah, it's definitely clunkier. So basically, the front derailleur has to physically move the chain from one chain ring to another. And when the chain ring is sort of bouncing up and down like that, the position on the front derailleur that pushes against the chain changes. And so the front derailleurs just aren't designed to handle it. If Osymmetric, the chain ring manufacturer, went out and made their own front derailleur, they might be able to make something that works better. But you're mixing and matching things that aren't designed to work together. So, yeah, I mean, the chance of a dropped chain increase, and definitely if you're sort of going from small ring to big ring, it might take an extra, you know, quarter of a second. Maybe you have to let off the power a little bit to do that. The mechanics at Sky are very good. Gary Blehm is very good. They certainly make it work.
And what do they feel like to ride? Have you ever had a go? And you said it takes a while to get used to. If you can, describe how it feels to pedal compared to a normal chainring.
Yeah, I've ridden both the Osymmetrics and the rotor version. Like I said, the rotors are sort of less dramatic. The difference is less dramatic, but you can feel them. I mean, it changes the way that your pedal stroke feels, in that it feels like you get through that dead spot a little bit faster. I never saw, and I rode them with a power meter, I never saw any increase in power, but I did sort of, you can definitely tell that they're on there. Personally, I noticed a drop in sprint power for some reason. I could never really explain it. And I was measuring power at the rear hub, so the chain rings would have had no effect. Yeah, I saw a drop in sprint power, but no increase in sort of threshold kind of power, and so I took them off after a little while.
So it kind of feels like a bit of a slip, does it, as you start the upstroke? Because part of the job for these guys, these professionals, is to make the pedaling stroke as efficient as possible and to pull up, generate as much power as possible there. So if it feels like it's sort of slipping through, but getting to the part where you can really push down again more quickly, sounds like something that the rider would have to adapt to. But I can kind of understand the theory behind that, because the downstroke is more powerful than the upstroke, I guess.
Yeah, the theory is definitely compelling. And it's been proven that, you know, the vast majority of your power comes from this very small little window within the pedal stroke. You're almost completely incapable of producing much power on the upstroke. Same with sort of 12 and 6 o'clock. You know, you're either kicking forward or pulling back, but you're not really producing power there so much as just unweighting your leg. Anyone who's ever ridden with, they're called power cranks, where essentially the two sides of the crank arms are not really connected. And so, you know, you have to physically pull your leg up every revolution, will quickly realize how lazy our legs are on that front in terms of picking its own weight up even. So there's not a lot of power coming from anywhere other than, you know, that heavy downstroke. And so, yeah, the theory makes sense. Like I said, there's just not a ton of real scientific data that proves it either one way or the other. The manufacturers of, you know, both Rotor and Osymmetric obviously have studies to prove, they say that prove that they work well. But I return to the fact that if it was really proven scientifically, you'd see the entire Tor Peloton on them. If it was actually worth a couple watts, I mean, these guys will do almost anything for a couple watts, and they haven't made the switch.
So in terms of Chris Froome, it's just a personal preference, something he's got used to and feels comfortable with. And as we know, even if the actual gain is really very small or negligible, if he feels that it makes him feel better, then there's an advantage there, I guess.
Absolutely. You know, power of the placebo, if nothing else. And there, like I said, there may be something there. We just don't really know. And, you know, it may depend on the way that he pedals in particular as well. I mean, everyone has sort of a slightly different pedal stroke. And if his just matches up well with the way that these things are designed, then good for him.
On the one hand, Chris Froome has been totally in control in his Tour de France, but on the other hand, he has had to make very quick, sharp decisions to keep himself in the race. We will never, ever forget the sight of him running up Mont Ventoux for as long as we live, I'm sure. And today, he had to have cool blood to not panic and take his teammate's bike at the right moment. Geraint Thomas was talking after the finish, and Geraint had apparently told Froome, or he said, chill through me when Mollema made that move, because
did you just call Chris Froome through me?
No, I was calling. I was
you
quoting.
Were quoting.
Geraint
Thomas. Just checking.
I was quoting Geraint Thomas calling Chris Froome through
me. G and through me.
So G told through me to take it easy on the descent or chill through me. But as Geraint said, you know, through me doesn't do chilling. So he kind of was the architect of his own downfall in a way. If he just maybe kept cool a bit and just waited for it all to just sort of settle down rather than hairing off. And then when he went down, Thomas then just heard Froome say, I need a bike. So they swapped bikes, and then Thomas said that the dragon on the top tube must have inspired Chris Froome for the final climb.
There's also the luck of the champion, you know. We always say that, but as you said before, you know, he crashed today. He was in trouble, like he'd been in the Ventoux, but then he was saved by the race jury. And this time, despite his crash, his lead increased, you know. And there was another luck of the champion, that because of Tom Dumoulin's, you know, crash, and on the day when he had trouble himself, is now the big Froome is now the big favorite for the time trial at the Olympics. So, you know, on a bad day for him, it might end up being a very good day for him, and that's what we call, you know, the luck of the champion.
Seb, would you agree with that? I think you spoke to Bernard Thévenet after the finish.
The tour is not over. Le Tour de France n'est pas fini. No, honestly, he has a big enough gap to probably win the Tour de France for the third time. But then again, what happened today, using Thomas's bike, could have some consequences for tomorrow's stage, because obviously the saddle's not at the same height. But and especially, he doesn't use an oval ring. Thomas doesn't use an oval ring. And I was actually speaking to a two-time Tour de France winner, Bernard Thévenet, who said that it could have consequences on his legs for tomorrow's stage, having to use a normal ring on basically 11, 12 kilometres.
I thought that after the running stage, I thought that after jogging up Mont Ventoux, he would also have sore legs the next day, but there were no real signs of that in the time trial, were there?
Trying to keep this the suspense.
That's what we want.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Whoever you are, wherever you ride, whatever the reason, Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses and communities all over the world. See rafa.cc for more information.
Thank you very much to our sponsors, Rafa, and I say it every night, but their alternative coverage of the race, More Than a Race, at rafa.cc is well worth checking out. Today there's an extract from Max Leonard's excellent book, Lantern Rouge, which different chapters on different riders who've finished last man in the Tour de France. Some real poignant stories in there, and then there's an extract on the Rafa website. Just now, a friend of the podcast, Max Leonard.
Yeah, well, just on Lantern Rouge, Rich, you made a kilometre zero on Sam Bennett, who's the current Lantern Rouge in this tour. He got through safely in the Gruppetto today, and one more day, and then he'll be certain to make Paris.
Britain's Dan McClay finished a couple of minutes off the back of the Gruppetto today, made the time cut by maybe another 2.5 minutes. We'll try and catch up with him tomorrow morning and find out how confident he is
Sam
of making
Bennett
it through.
As well. If we don't catch up with him tomorrow, we'll catch up with him in Paris, assuming he makes it. Hope he does. And thanks very much, everyone, for their response to that kilometre zero. He's had a really tough time. A lot of riders have. And he's battled on. As he said in that episode, he'll be heading to Germany on Monday to have his hand looked at, possibly operated on, and he's been surviving with that quite nasty injury since day one. So, you know, a guy riding his second Tour de France, but this would be the first one he finished. That'd be a huge achievement, I think. So, yeah, oh, there, Francois. I always think it's the Marseillaise on your phone, is it? No, it's not. You got actually quite offended the other day when I suggested it was the Marseillaise.
It's not the Marseillaise. You know what it is? It is from an LP by a guy called Andy Lewis. He's the bass player with Paul Weller.
I knew it'd be something much cooler than the Marseillaise. I knew it.
Add a quick one about the Lanterne Rouge, because my favorite Lanterne Rouge ever came from Marseille. Can't remember his name, but he had the famous phrase to explain who he was. He said, "I can't sprint, I can't climb, I'm not a ruler, I'm a versatile rider."
An all-rounder. A jack of all trades. We must, before I forget, say a massive thank you to Chris Cole at La Gietaz, Chalet La Gietaz, where we've been staying the last couple of nights, and indeed tonight. And we did a live event there last night, which we did as a Facebook Live event as well. And big audience, a wonderful atmosphere, and a really fun event. Kayleigh Fretz and Tom Carey joined us for that. It was a lot of fun, and Chris has been a fantastic host, giving us great food and one or two post-event beers last night.
Very much
one
so.
Or two. It was one or
yeah,
two.
Yeah, one or two.
But it was great fun, lovely people, and an amazing setup he's got there. Chalet in the beautiful sort of village of La Gietaz.
I think it's La Gieta.
La Gieta.
Yeah, you don't pronounce the Z in those places.
Yeah. You tell me. Well, La Gieta.
We were told that you do, but I mean, yeah, you either do or you don't.
Hang on, what do you know about this, Francois? You know.
Nobody knows. I mean, even us French guys, when we reach those places, we don't know how to pronounce them. What we know is mostly in the Alps, when you have a Z at the end of the word, you usually don't pronounce the Z. So.
It's interesting because our lovely lady who records our jingles for the podcast at the Tour de France, when she runs through the places, she doesn't always know how to pronounce the place.
Wow.
Reims is the one that always confuses us, isn't it? Reims. Yeah.
Two examples for today. Col de la Forclaz, and not la Forclaz. Mm. And la Montée du Bété, and not the Betex.
Because
you've been saying Betex all
day. Yeah, of course.
All day.
Of course.
All day.
There you go. Yeah.
Of course. Oh, well. Well, we now.
We're just fumbling around France.
At least we're improving, though, aren't we? We're correcting the podcast in the same episode rather than the following day, which is a big improvement.
La Gieta, beautiful chalet in La Gieta. Do go and stay there if you can. It's an amazing location and wonderful, really beautiful spot in the Alps. Very green. I posted a couple of pictures this morning. The view from my balcony is just amazing. Go there.
Shall we return to the Tour de France?
Let's return to the Tour de France.
It's a big day tomorrow now, isn't it? And all of a sudden, I think we've had a few listeners comment that we've maybe been a little bit down on the Tour de France and you know, it's not all about the GC battle. But, of course, it is mostly about the GC battle, isn't it? You want to see the biggest riders all having a go at each other, either on the climbs or on the descents. But today it really came alive, and it struck me that the one thing that the teams can't control, no matter how big their budget is, it's the weather. If it's rainy again like this, and the rain is really coming down quite hard now and splashing on me rather unpleasantly, so I'm just going to shuffle back here.
Wow.
And may even take our electrical equipment out of harm's way and just come back in a second.
No, we're okay. Carry on, Lionel.
Oh, I'm getting wet.
You know, I mean, that's fine.
Okay.
As long as the recorder's not getting wet, it's fine.
Okay. So tomorrow, what are we expecting? There's a very tricky descent off the Jouplin towards the end, but I gather the middle part of the stage will be technical as well.
With the rain, you can expect anything. That's what everybody was telling me this morning. I talked to Philippe Maudieu, also the Lampre Merida team director. He said, with the rain, we all start from scratch, he said, you know. And he even said that Rui Costa would be in the break, and he was right, you know. And so tomorrow we can expect much more of the same, actually, because even if they decide to play it safe and you know, and stay on the brakes, that's exactly what you shouldn't do when it rains. So I really don't know. We could have. I think we're in for more surprises.
And Chris Froome does have a very healthy lead still, but he's human. And when you crash on the bike, it makes you nervous. He got back on and it was a climb to the finish. But it'll be in the back of his mind tomorrow on the descent, especially if it's wet.
I suspect that tomorrow maybe, as usual, we might have an attack by Nairo Quintana at long last, you know.
Finally. This is traditional, isn't it? The final day in the mountains.
Because he said he was affected by allergies and that he was expecting that the allergies were due to the dust and the sunny weather we had for a couple of days. And he was hoping for the rain to help. Today was a little bit better than the previous day. So if he wants to save his standard and his status as a leading tour contender, we might see an attack by Quintana tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, Lionel, as you said, some people have been giving us a bit of a hard time for appearing to be a bit down on the race, but I think we don't care who wins. We want an exciting race. We just want a close, exciting race. We want there to be drama, suspense. We don't want the thing to be done and dusted with a few days to go, and especially when these 4 days in the Alps have been billed as being the decisive, exciting stages. Today, thanks to the weather, and that is, it's not something to be depressed about or to bemoan the fact that this weather came in. This is part of bike racing, and
coping
with this weather is part of bike racing. And so sometimes riders make mistakes when they're put under pressure. We saw it at the Giro with Stephen Kruijswijk. On the one hand, you can say he was hugely unlucky. He was riding to the win at the Giro. But on the other hand, you can say, well, Nibali put him under an awful lot of pressure.
And he made a mistake.
And almost forced the mistake. Now, riders have seen, and it was on the final climb today, I was thinking, Froome is on someone else's bike. Now is the time. And I was thinking, why aren't they attacking? Then you see Richie Porte drop off, and you realise he's at his limit. So it's not as easy to sit there in the press room and say, why aren't you attacking? I think an Astana made the race very hard today. Who knows how that stage would have unfolded had Nibali not crashed with Froome. But people will be encouraged to put Froome under pressure again tomorrow, I think, and especially perhaps on the descent.
Yeah. And credit to the riders in general. This morning when I got up, because I'm in Chamonix, and it's a ski resort, and you have workup alpine skiing races there. And when I saw those clouds over the mountains, I thought to myself, if this was a skiing race, they wouldn't go on, you know? Well, you know, alpine skiers are really mavericks. They go down the slopes at 120 k's an hour, so they're not, you know, cowards. But even so, with such weather, they wouldn't ski, you know? So once again, credits to the riders, because they really do. Well, their sport is something else.
Yeah. And we should finish off, but we should get Seb again to tell us a bit about Romain Bardet's win today, because I do think back to the second rest day press conference when Bardet said he would not be happy with sixth place overall. You know, and everybody said, well, he's saying the right things and all the rest of it, but does he mean it? And I think today he showed that he does mean that, and he's going to be prepared to really take the race on.
François will agree or not, but I have never seen Romain Bardet so enthusiastic, so happy about being on his bike, happy about attacking, happy about the outcome of the Tour de France.
You interviewed him after the stage, didn't you? I think it was you,
wasn't it? No, this morning, actually. And he is super enthusiastic. It's a tour he loves. It's an attacking tour for himself. And I think he's going to give it another go tomorrow. We're talking about Jouplan. Jouplan is going to be a real nightmare. It's a climb that a well-known rider used to hate.
Controversial rider.
No.
Naught times winner from America.
Naught times winner. And it's going to be the final climb of the Tour de France. And I think the decision for the podium will be made maybe not going up Jouplan, but going down to Morzine, and let's not forget La Ramaz. No, La Rama, because you don't pronounce the Z.
Yes,
I got it wrong there. La Rama is another tough one. Now, again, there were some questions on the fact that La Rama would be...
There's been a landslide, hasn't there?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And it depended on the weather. Now, the weather was obviously awful today. Shouldn't be too good tomorrow. So will the Rama remain on the course tomorrow? That's an important question.
Bardet is going to come out of this tour, I think, with his reputation greatly enhanced, isn't he? And you know, of all the French riders who came in hotly tipped to do something, he's a guy who's really lived up and maybe exceeded people's expectations. And I think people will probably start talking about him as a potential Tour winner one day. He's still very young.
Yeah, he's still very young. He has the physique of a Chris Froome, whereas a guy like Pinot is not exactly built the same way. I have a lot of faith in Romain Bardet. I think he definitely has the potential to one day win the Tour de France, because he's improving in every types of domain. Now, maybe to win the Tour de France, he should change teams.
Yeah, the other thing is, you know, he was lucky that the second time trial of the Tour de France was an uphill time trial. Had it been a flat time trial, he wouldn't be second overall today. And the main problem with Romain Bardet is that he really needs to improve his TT skills. But as we know, if he does that, he might lose a little bit of his climbing abilities. So it's a very difficult balance to find. And I still believe that potentially Thibaut Pinot is probably... I mean, I know it sounds crazy to say a thing like this after the tour we've seen. The real edge Bardet has over Pinot is mental. You know, he's really strong in his head. He always was, but he was a little bit nervous. He's matured a lot, and on this tour, he showed really, really, maturity, you know, will. And even as we said at the start of this cycling podcast, a knack, you know, to tell the public when they want to hear what they want to hear, like, you know, I did this on instinct and blah blah blah. He's aware of the romanticism of the tour and that the French public wants that. So for now, he's got an advance on Pinot and the others. We'll see later. But winning the tour, we'll see.
I think he's definitely very sincere in what he says. You should have seen the tears in his eyes at the finish. I don't know if it was on TV, but he was really, really, really emotional behind the podium. So were all the team, obviously, because winning a stage on the tour is always special, especially here in the Alps. I think he's very sincere in what he says. But to come back on what François said on Pinot and Bardet, and looking at the way, again, it's always the same debate, the way Sky are conducting their Tour de France and on how powerful they seem, I think the French have really, really have lessons to take from Sky. French,
well,
and others, actually.
Froome is still the, you know, hot favourite to win. Let's hear a little excerpt from our first French special of 2016. You can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. £10 for 11 episodes throughout the year. They're a little bit different to our regular sort of output. I was in the laboratory with Chris Froome in West London last August, just after the last year's tour, when he went for physiological tests. Took my recorder along and spoke to him during those tests, and we produced our French special in January. Here is a clip from that French special.
Okay, Chris, welcome. Today we're going to go through a number of tests with you. We're going to start off by doing something called a DEXA scan.
It's something that I've wanted to do for quite a while now. Even at the beginning of the season, I was looking into it, and then obviously during the Tour de France, it became a more immediate need to do some physiological testing.
So we start off by doing a submaximal test, which is going to basically be a step test where we start you at a nice, easy intensity.
Come on, Chris!
Come on, Bob!
Come on,
Bob!
Keep going!
Come on! Come on!
Where can we go?
Where can we go?
Were you nervous before?
Yeah, a little bit nervous. I mean, at the end of the day, I think whatever the number is, I wasn't going to be able to change that. It's not as if I could pedal faster.
Become a friend of the podcast for 2016. For £10, you'll have access to our friend specials, 11 in-depth episodes that will take you even further inside the sport. All our friend specials are now available on your mobile device. Our 2015 Friends specials are also still available for £5. To sign up, visit www.thecyclingpodcast.com.
So that was a little clip from the Froome test, which was our first Friends special of this year. And do sign up to become a friend if you haven't already. Thanks very much to everyone who signed up during the tour. We should definitely leave things there. It was an exciting stage, and we've talked about it at length. And hopefully we'll have another exciting stage tomorrow.
Yeah, just one very last word, though, on Wout Poels.
One word.
Amazing.
That's it. Great. Well, thank you very much. Thank you very much. Lionel, thank you.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Francois.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, Seb Piquet.
Thank you, and I hope we won't run over a gendarme tomorrow.
should just point out, we haven't run over any gendarmes before. The lawyers get involved.
Not planning to either.
No.